Okay, I'm ready.
Hello, family. Hey, it's a Wednesday, November 19th. We decided to fire back up the podcast because I want some more information. So just so you all know, and the purpose of these podcasts, you know, currently where we are, Dad does daily meditations and sends them out. And the purpose of those meditations is kind of to help us all or at least facilitate our grieving process that we're going through with Mom's passing here, you know, nine months ago now. But the purpose of these podcasts is kind of an anthology or a history to be passed on orally, you know, from generation to generation. So, you know, the topics will vary from, I think I said it earlier, Dad, it was, you know, existentialism to pop culture to, you know, anything in between. So tonight's topic, I'd like to talk about something that I think that kind of cripples us all, but especially the younger generation. So we're speaking to the grandkids at this point, is the fear of failure and how crippling that is, you know, and how it impacts our decision-making and not only what we do, but what we don't do. And sometimes more importantly, what we don't do. So, you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, Dad.
Well, that's a very interesting topic. And it's funny that we're talking about it tonight because last night I just spent some time on the phone with O'Malley talking about the failure. And after I hung up with that conversation, I did some thinking about it before I went to bed. And I don't know how, I can't remember ever fearing failure. And I don't know if that's an accurate of something that I did, but I don't ever remember.
No, and it's interesting because I you know, now that you bring that up, I don't, when I was younger, certainly, you know, I may have gained that trait the older I've gotten, but I certainly never feared failure. In fact, I welcomed it. Like it was like a challenge.
Well, the earliest, I tried to take a mental review of situations that major events in my life where I could have chose not to respond positively to something. And the earliest one I can think of, and I've shared this with a lot of you and with a lot of the grandkids, as you know, when I was 9 years old, I was hit by a car by a drunk driver, driven by a drunk driver. And they got me, and medicine was nowhere near as sophisticated then as, well, it was 1949. And the ambulance people, well, my mom and dad met me at the hospital. No, my dad came in the ambulance with me. That was it. And they took me to a hospital in Detroit. I lived in Farmington. And I'm going to guess that was at least a 20-minute ride. I was unconscious for most of it. And it wasn't until the next day that I woke up in the hospital. But my mom, when I woke up, my mom and dad were sitting beside my bed. And when I opened my eyes, my mom reached over and gave me a big hug, and she had tears in her eyes. And she said, the doctors told us they didn't know if you'd wake up. They didn't know if you'd make it through the night. And I said, well, why? Where am I? What's going on? And they told me I'd been hit by a drunk driver, that I had severe brain injuries, and that probably explains a lot of my life. But I had two broken legs, a broken arm, a severed arm that the doctors or mom or somebody told me the only thing that kept my arm attached to my body was the bicep muscle, that everything else had been, the car had an ornament over the headlight that was made of metal and it acted just like a knife and sliced my arm off when I was off. And I had a broken wrist. And I was in the hospital. I don't remember, at least a month. I want to say it was two or three, but it doesn't make any difference. The point is that this is the first time I can remember facing failure. And I was down in the casting room. And my father was inside talking with the doctor that was going to put a body cast on me. The body cast went from the tip of my toes all the way up to my armpits. And I was in that body cast for about 9 months. And the doctor, I heard the doctor say, so I'm 9 years old. I was in fourth grade at the time. And I heard the doctor say, and I don't know if Dad had asked him, but I heard the doctor say, we don't know if you'll ever walk again. And I remember saying to myself, yes, I will walk. There's no doubt about it. And so 9 months later, 8 months, 9 months, I think it was 9 months, when they cut that body cast off me, my legs looked like two toothpicks. If you could imagine being enclosed, I had no strength in them. And I don't remember now how long it took me before I could walk, but I walked. And I went on to play sports in high school and live a very normal life. So that's the first time I can remember saying, no, I will not fail. I will walk. I don't care what you say. And of course, that was said out of ignorance. I had no medical background. But then as I continued to think about how many times in my life I was told I was too short, too small, I wasn't smart enough. And each and every time, those words, rather than hurting my feelings, inspired me to prove those people wrong. And the reason why was I was not going to let anybody have control over my mind or my body. It was my body, my mind, and I'll decide what's going to happen. And I don't care what you think, because I'm not here to please you. I don't answer to you. I'm here to please me. And I've often said, and you've heard me say it, it's the only person you have to please in life is the guy looking back at you when you look in the mirror, or woman, as it may be. And so I've always, that was always my last check when I was about to do something that had some risk to it. Is this the right thing? And I'd look myself in the mirror. And I always found the right answer, which was, yeah. And so I can remember eighth grade. So this is 4 years after my accident. I was just barely able to run, but I wanted to play on the eighth grade baseball team. And so it was after the season had started, and I went out. There was a priest coaching it. And I went out and asked the father if I could be on the team. And he said, well, we've already started the season. He said, I don't have any uniforms left. And I said, I don't care. I'll play. Back then we had to wear shirts, long sleeve shirts, and ties and dress pants and dresses. I said, I'll play in my school clothes. Well, I did. And I remember, I don't know how long it was before I got to play, but I finally got to play in a game. And I don't know if it was the first time at bat, but all I remember was a kid throwing me a curveball. And I recognized it, and I sat and waited on it. And I drove it over the left field fence. And as it turned out, that was the winning hit in the game. So that reinforced my commitment that nobody, this wasn't supposed to happen. I was not ever supposed to be able to do this. And so those kinds of experiences convinced me that the only judgment that mattered to me was my judgment and those people like my parents who played kind of an advisory role. They were my guardian angels, so to speak. I would listen to them. But other than that, and I was blessed with good parents, they never called me stupid. They said, you're smarter than that, as a matter of fact. And so I remember my ninth grade year going out. I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, University of Detroit, in Detroit for 3 years before I went to Assumption. And they were having football tryouts. And I just loved sports. I loved competition. And so I went down to the office when they told us to and signed up to play freshman football. And I went to the first practice. And I'm standing out there on the field. And I can't see anybody that was shorter than me. And as it turned out, there were over 120 kids trying out for the team. And I don't remember now how many they kept, 30, 40. But I do remember the day that we had some practice days, tryout days, whatever you want to call them. And the coaches calling us all together and said that they had decided on whatever number of players it was. And that these players, when you heard your name called, go down to the locker room, to the equipment room, and get your football gear. And the rest of you, thank you for trying out. And so I'm looking around, and I'm thinking, oh, man, I don't know if I'm going to make it. My name was, oh, I don't know, eighth, ninth, tenth name called. And I literally skipped all the way across the practice field into the basement to get my equipment. So that was another time that the odds were against me, and I was small. I probably, I don't even know if I was 5'7", maybe 5'8", but I weighed about 125 pounds. But then I come out the next day to practice with gear on, and I'm looking at all these big kids around me. And I thought, man, I don't know if this is the right choice I made here. I'm never going to see the field. Well, when it came time to start, I was a starting guard. And I remember when we were told who was the starting players and what positions they were going to play, I thought for sure, I had my heart set on being a running back, and they made me an offensive guard. If you notice in my email today, my alias email is Scott, S-C-O-T, for the Alma Scots, and then the number 66. That was my number on the first football team I ever played on. And I started, and I was a starter on the freshman team, the junior varsity team, and I started on a varsity, I don't remember how many games I started. No, it was my senior year. So I played on the varsity my junior year. It was my senior year. So I was returning letterman, and we always had kids coming and going from all over the world, and we had two Italian kids, literally just got off the boat from Italy, Fernando and Carlo were their names. And they were not a whole lot bigger than me, but man, were they tough. And so we were competing on the football field. They were both guards. And the coaches were playing one of us off against the other all the time, trying to find out which one they wanted to start. And so I think it was Fernando won the starting job. And so I was extremely mad and disappointed. And I don't know, somebody, I don't know, I don't remember now how it got going, but down in the locker room afterwards, Fernando was kind of a braggart, and he was a hard-nosed kid. But he said something that ticked me off. And first thing I know, the two of us are in a fist fight down in the locker room. And I mean, it was a knockdown, bloody fight. And I don't know if we ever had a decided winner. But I walked off the field that day and said, that's it, I'm done. And I went in the next day and quit my senior year. And I don't know, a day or two later, I said to myself, you know, why did you quit? What did you prove? You made an irrational decision in a moment of pure passion and emotion that you now regret. And I was too proud to go back and say, and we were, I don't know how many games we were into the season by then. And so I had to live with that decision that I quit. But it was so painful of me not to be a part of that team. But more importantly, I denied myself an opportunity to find out who really was the better guy. I let a few practices decide, and the coaches decide, based on a few practices, that Fernando was better than me. And I could have stayed around the whole season and kept fighting to get the job back. But I didn't. But in that moment of failure, that's the first time I can really remember feeling, I learned an important lesson. I'll never quit. And I never did again. And the next time I quit was when I hung up my hockey, my goalie pads, when I finally accepted the fact that I was not good enough to play in the National Hockey League. And they didn't have many Americans playing back then. There were only six teams in the NHL. But when I hung them up, and I loved that playing hockey more than I loved girls. And in fact, it cost me a couple girlfriends when they, I remember one particularly was having a big party and she wanted me to come. And I said, no, I got a hockey game. And she said, well, if you don't come to my party, I'm not going to be your girlfriend. And I said, well, good luck with the next guy. And I went to my hockey game. But I learned from that failure quote when I quit, that what other people thought of me and my abilities didn't matter to me, because I was not ever going to surrender control of my future, my life, to a bunch of strangers who I would never please. I was always going to be too short, too small, not fast enough, not smart, all of that. So I knew better. So fast forward now, when I talk to athletes, particularly at this end of my coaching career, where my coaching career is all over, and I've coached some great athletes, a couple of them, maybe half a dozen have played in the National Football League. So they were pretty good. For the most part in my coaching career until I got to St. Louis, I coached on championship teams. And so I really hadn't experienced losing. And it was not unusual for, like when I was coaching in the Detroit Catholic League, I coached at three schools down there. And we played in the toughest division, I think, in the state at that time, the Catholic League of Detroit. And it was not unusual for us to have four or five Division I players go every year to the big programs, the Michigans and the Michigan States, et cetera. So I didn't realize that I was blessed with a great deal of talent. And I always thought it was the great coaching that brought us the wins. But anyway, I come to St. Louis. And when I took my first head job up at Manistee Catholic Central High School, and I really loved it there, I followed the legend. And the superintendent, who was a priest, when they offered me the job, I was down in Detroit. And, of course, Catholic Central is in Manistee, 250 miles away. And Mom and I rode up. I wanted Mom to see the area. And we had to pick out a house where we were going to live. And I sat down with the superintendent. And this is a priest now. And he takes my contract. It's laying in front of him. And he puts his finger on it, and he slides it over to me, and he turns it around so I can read it. And he said, "Now, Mike, I want you to understand, if you don't win, you won't be back." And I said, "Father, I don't see, you've given me, these are good athletes. I've talked with all of them. I met with all of the athletes individually, one-on-one, the coaching staff, the parents. And there's no reason why I can't succeed here." And so I did. First year our record was 8-1. I didn't know what losing was until I got to St. Louis. So when I got to St. Louis, I was the head coach there for 5 years. And I gave it just like I did when I was trying to get my way into the NHL. The day I put up my goalie pads, I knew I had tried every single ounce of my body went into trying to make it into the league. And I finally had to look that man in the face in the mirror and say, "You're not good enough." And that was a very peaceful day for me. There was no regret because I'd done my best. And if I had to do it over again, I couldn't have done any better. Well, with St. Louis, the failure, I don't remember. We had one year where we didn't win a game. Most of the other 4 years, I think we won at least four games. I don't remember. But anyway, we weren't, I was used to winning in championships, and we weren't experiencing them. But the point is, I worked harder in those 5 years to get myself better as a coach. I just could not accept A, coaching guys that I could not motivate to be better every single snap of every single practice to improve. And that when they went out to play game night, It was a war. We were savages at St. Louis, and yet, looking back, we didn't have any talent. I had one team there that had, and Michael, you'll know them, the Einstein brothers. One of them had the state Class B record in the 100-yard dash. They were doing 100 yards back then. And Don might still have that record, but he was fast. But I didn't have an offensive line. Anyway, I finally, at the end of the fifth year, I thought it was time that somebody else got a chance to do what I couldn't do. But I knew I had done every single thing, and that those 5 years, to the outside, to the people that weren't involved in the program, I was a losing coach. But I know that after 5 years of coaching St. Louis, I was a heck of a lot more of a coach than the first day I stepped on the St. Louis football field, because I had worked so hard to get better. I went to Mike Allen and I, we went to colleges and sat down. We went to coaching conventions. I developed relationships with coaches at Michigan, Central Michigan, and I was always in their offices asking them, how would you do this? How do you do that? Show me how you do it. And then I went to Alma College, and that was a great staff. And the winning picked right up again. And I guess what I'm trying to say is failure is never fatal. Failure is an opportunity to reevaluate and to learn. And I learned, with all the success I had, I learned more from those 5 years about how to coach and what was important than I did all the other years coaching everywhere else. And so I always tried to pass that on, and now to the grandchildren, that there's nothing to fear in failure. Failure is when you are afraid of not living up to someone else's expectations of you. And you want to be at least as good as everybody else. And so you're letting other people set the standards for you. And I refuse to do that. And when you set your own standards, and it's not just willpower. I mean, sitting down, for example, our defensive line play, well, Michael, when I was coaching with you, those kids, they had no idea how to play defensive line. So my chore, my challenge was, number one, how can I convince them to want to come out and practice hard every day? And two, how could I convince them that they could win? And so, and Michael, you witnessed it. It was daily practice. I would set very small goals for each of the defensive linemen during our position time. I want you to work today on hand placement. Where do your two hands go? The next day, it was, okay, where do your hands go? And I want you to lock out your elbows. The next day was your target. Where are you going to the punch with your hands? And the, you know, rather than, I broke my goal down to get them to believe in themselves.
And that's the hard thing, like, for a lot of everyone to do, is to break those goals down into bite size. Like they see it as this mountain to climb, that why is it even, you know, why do I even try climbing it, because the mountain's too big.
Well, look at when you guys were in Ireland, right?
Yeah,
you climbed Kilpatrick one step at a time, right?
Yeah.
And you didn't, well, I don't know, but you didn't think about, your goal was to get to the top. And you saw all these people coming down or sliding by you, going back down the hill, or falling or getting hurt, or just saying, I can't do this, didn't you?
Yeah. Okay. All of the above.
And why did you keep going?
Because I wasn't to the top yet.
There you go. You know? But you broke it down into small steps, learning how to walk on gravel, learning how to walk on shale, and learning how to dress for it when you get to the top. It was about 32 degrees when it got there. And Michael was in a t-shirt and shorts, weren't you?
Yeah, I had a hoodie. That was as warm as I. Luckily I had the hoodie, but I was not prepared to climb a mountain that day. No.
So, I guess that's what I would like, and that's what I see in the grandchildren. Now, like Trav. You know, one play, one life. The play that happened before is gone. The next play hasn't happened yet. The only play that Trav is in control of is the one that he's doing right now. So focus on doing it. All the little teeny things that go into if he's going to hand off, if he's going to run with the ball. Rowan and her shooting, her hand placement, and her spot up. You know, just focusing on that. And then, I'm a real big believer in this, you can practice when you are laying in bed at night. How do you do that, Michael?
Visualization.
That's right. Perfect visualization.
Yes.
And it's called cybernetics. And you look that up in the dictionary, and it is the professional athletes have psychologists, they're sports psychologists that take, I don't know exactly how they do it. I used to. They used to have these big, like a backyard swimming pool. And the guys would go in the facility where their locker room was, where they had this dark room. And after they got done with their group meetings, they would all go in to the pool, and they get on these rafts, and they close their eyes, and it's pitch black in there. And all they would do is float around visualizing every single tiny step that they had to do in their responsibility on the team. And so your mind doesn't know. The mind only knows what your senses, the information that your senses send it. So if you touch something hot, your fingers say, hey, this is hot. And the message goes to the brain. So the brain recognizes it. But as I've done with some of you, and Mike, do you remember the old lemon?
No, I still bring that up.
Try, tell. Let me see how good you. How does that go?
Well, I'm going to fast forward it, but you take a very detailed approach to the process of, you have everyone close their eyes and you explain in a very detailed way, pulling a lemon out of the fridge. And, you know, it's a bright yellow lemon with some waxy skin. And you take this lemon and you spin it around and you look at it and you notice how yellow it is and how it just... the dimples and how perfect it is, and you take the cutting board out and you take the knife out and you lay this lemon out on the cutting board and you chop it in half, and oh man, what a juicy lemon, because as soon as you slice it just juice comes out onto the cutting board, and you chop it into slices and you take that first slice and you put it up, and just right before you get it to your mouth, you can smell the citrus in that lemon, and you know what's about to hit your mouth, and you know, you're describing this in detail to everyone, and you tell them, you know, okay, well, you've just, you know, you're putting this lemon in your mouth, and then you ask everybody, you know, what did you feel in that moment when you were putting that lemon in your mouth? And without fail, everyone would say that their mouth was watering.
And what did that prove?
It proved that your mind is more powerful than
reality.
You know, reality, that what you tell your mind, you can program your mind to do anything that you want it to do by telling it that over and over and making your own reality.
So you want to be a good shooter in basketball? You can practice shooting at home with perfect visualization. Well, I coached you in basketball, Michael. What was one part of our free throw shooting that we did? Do you remember?
We had to shoot. We had to perfectly visualize 10 free throws before we shot one. And then we had to. Sorry, go ahead.
How did you shoot 5 free throws?
What do you mean? I mean, you visualized.
Right. And then after the visualization, now you're going to shoot the free throws. What did I have you do? Usually it was the first 5 free throws you had to shoot with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
And what was the result?
More often than not, if you weren't making them, you were closer than you thought you would be with your eyes closed.
Right. And so in a game, how did that translate into the game?
It slowed the game down. You didn't have to think about what you were doing. Your mind already knew what to do, and it told your body, do these things and you'll make it, and you do it.
Yeah. So I guess,
I mean, to wrap it up, like, fear of failure. You're gonna fail, failure is an opportunity to learn. You can't see it. It's about perspective. And if you're afraid to fail, then you're afraid to learn, because that's all you're doing with that attempt is, you know, the first iteration, the first try at whatever you're doing, and then you're gonna reevaluate, you know, what worked, what didn't work, and make another attempt at it.
And so this concept, while we're using it in an athletic situation, it's true in life. You know, it doesn't matter. Look at Gabe. He wasn't the biggest, the strongest, but I don't know how many guys were in his flight. He got some award for physical fitness out there, right?
I don't think he got one for physical fitness, but it was. Leadership, but I would say if you're going to talk about Gabe, talk about him being a center on a class A football team. You know, when his left guard is 325 and his right guard is 305, and you know they're all 6'5", and he is 5'9", 150.
Yeah, that's true. Yep. And so, you know, if you were to, if Gabe would have said, oh man, I'm too small, he would have denied himself the opportunity to prove that he could do it, not condemning himself to failure without even trying. That's the point. And with that, that's the end of today's sermon.
Yeah, no, again, the message is, like, whatever you tell yourself, you're exactly right. Yeah. If you tell yourself you're going to do it, you're exactly right. If you tell yourself you're not going to do it, you're exactly right. So, you know, just be determined to see it through to the end. You know, and take those failures as opportunities to learn and get better for the next time you encounter similar circumstances, rather than a condemnation of yourself or your abilities or anything like that.
Well, and I would like to, we're done, Mike, but I would like to add one more quality. I mean, there's a lot of qualities that go in. Mike and I have simplified it down to its Reader's Digest, even though it's 40 minutes, but everything you do, do it out of love. And I'm speaking specifically of the family now. When we were in Mom's room those 3 days before she died, including the day she died, love was tangible. I could feel it. I'd never experienced it like that. I thought Mom and I were married for 62 years, and I never thought I could love my mother anymore, my wife anymore. But during those 3 days, seeing you guys holding your mother, praying with your mother, talking with your mother, comforting your mother, leading her through prayers, and then not only doing it for Karen, but with each other. And since then, the care and love that you demonstrate to each other is the glue, the cement that gives you guys a perfect family. And if you will never lose sight of loving each other and supporting each other, you'll have a very long, happy relationship in life. And with that, I'm done.
All right. Well, thank you, Dad. I appreciate your time tonight. And those are some great words. And I'm excited to listen to them over and over.
I hope. All right, guys. Love you all dearly.
Love you, Dad.
All right. Good night.
Good night.